Since the terrorist attacks of 2001, scientists and policymakers have gone to battle over the issue of whether some scientific information should be put in the public domain or whether doing so poses too great a risk to national security. Case in point, the complete sequences for microbial genomes, such as smallpox, anthrax, SARS, and Ebola. Those genome sequences, like all genome data generated with federal funds, are put into a public database that anyone can access, including potential terrorists. How can this information be kept from terrorists? Is the solution to restrict access to these databases? Classify some genomic data deemed too sensitive to go public, or would doing so slow scientists' effort to develop countermeasures to these deadly pathogens? Those are the questions tackled by a committee convened by the National Academy of Science. Last week, they issued their report, and today we'll talk with the committee's chair. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my guests. Stanley Falco is the Cahill Professor in Cancer Research and a Professor of Microbiology and Immunology and of Medicine at Stanford University in Stanford, California. He joins me today by phone from Hamilton, Montana. Welcome to the program, Dr. Falco.
Thanks, Joe. I'm glad to be here.
And my other guest is Gerald Epstein. He's an adjunct professor in the Security Studies Program at George Washington University and a senior fellow for science and security in the Homeland Security Program of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and he joins me here today in the studios of NPR. Welcome to the program, Dr. Epstein.
Welcome. Glad to be here.
So, Dr. Falco, I'd like to start with you. Your report didn't focus so much on, was not supposed to focus on the pathogens or the microbes or the bacteria, the viruses themselves, but the genome sequences that they're made up of. And just so we're all on the same page, can we talk for a minute about what it means to do the complete genome sequence of an organism? What do you learn from that, actually? What is that?
Well, it's the complete blueprint in principle that the organism uses for all of its functions. So for most microorganisms, bacteria, for example, which have large genomes, a lot of it is concerned with getting nutrition, replicating, and these properties are common to all kinds of microorganisms, whether they're pathogens or not pathogens. The fact is that a third of all the genes in all the sequenced bacteria so far are still unknown, of unknown function, and have no known homologs to anything else. So the more we sequence, the more we find out what we don't know.
Huh. So I guess, you know, as someone who's reported on this for years myself, I've used the word blueprint, but I think that maybe is what gets people a little confused here, because a blueprint is something that supposedly spells out exactly the instructions for building the organism. But if you have the complete genome, that doesn't mean you know everything there is to know about the organism, right?
Certainly. We know very little. I mean, it's really looking at a flat plane, so you don't see the interconnections and how it works. The concept that a microorganism is constantly testing its environment and biochemically translating what it feels in the sense of temperature and pH and all other kinds of factors, the ions in the environment, and somehow does this instantly and adapts its biochemistry accordingly, is one of the things we'd love to be able to understand, but we don't.
So what are the issues? Is it a concern at all for someone to have access to this information that wants to use it for, I think, what Dr. Epstein calls contentious purposes? We'll talk about nefarious purposes, or just, you know, to say for, to use for terrorist purposes.
Well, you can't look at the genome of a pathogen and somehow deduce how it is pathogenic and how it does its thing. There is nothing inherent in looking at the genome that tells you that. The availability of the complete genomes of lots of microorganisms, and there are well over 100 in the public domain, which includes, I might add, virtually every single potential bioterror threat agent that is been considered, really doesn't give you that much information. It makes our work a lot easier in the laboratory, for sure.
Right. Now, your committee basically, just to give the punchline, came up and looked at all these things, considered various security measures, and basically said, "What we can't really think of a way to put brakes on. We should pretty much continue to make these things publicly available." And we'll go into the reasons for that. But, Dr. Epstein, I wonder if I can turn to you now and say, you know, was this committee misguided in coming out in this recommendation, or do you think they were on the right track?
No, I think they were on the right track, and I think the most important result was that the study was done at all. I've been very interested that the scientific community take on these questions and deliberately consider what the right answer is, whether there should be more reviews of research is undertaken, whether material that's always been put into public should continue to be done so. I think the great danger is for the community to not think about these deliberately and to look like or have others appear to believe that the scientific community doesn't care about these. So I'm glad that the Academy has sat down and studied this particular issue in detail. And this follows on a previous study the National Academy has done on a broader question, which also was a commendable effort to seriously think through these issues.
But, okay, so I can imagine a horrible day in the future when a new pathogen is unleashed upon the world, right? And it was unleashed on purpose. And through expert detective work, somebody discovers that, in fact, a scientist made use of some information about a pathogen that they got from the Internet about the gene, the sequence, the DNA sequence. And you have to stand in front of a congressional committee and say, it's great that you thought about these things, but why didn't you do something? What are you going to say when that, if that day should come to pass?
Well, we have a lot of assumptions in the hypothetical. I think there's two questions the committee looked at. One is, would you like to restrict this information? Can you do so in a way that doesn't prevent you from doing things that are as or more important? And then the other question, which may be an easier one to answer, is could you do it if you wanted to? Do you actually have the ability to restrict information and monitor it, regulate it, figure out who gets it and who doesn't have it? Define what it is that goes in the box that you're regulating so that everything else goes outside. It turns out these practical questions can be incredibly difficult to work out, so that even if you went to the issue saying we absolutely have to control this, figuring out what you're going to control, how you're going to control it, who you're going to control it from, who's going to issue the passes to read it, can be an incredibly complicated problem. And if you can't solve that, you shouldn't start going down that road.
I see. So a bad solution could be worse than no solution.
Absolutely. A bad solution is worse than no solution.
Okay. But if the answer is you should think about it, that's a non-event in an outcome sense.
You should think about it, and you should come up with whatever the right answer is in that case and be able to make that case to people who are looking over your shoulder saying, why aren't you controlling that better? So this panel has done that. They said this information is needed for legitimate purposes, both to defend against the very weapons we worry about, as for the conduct of science, and they have to go through and be able to defend that point, so that's someone coming at them with a perspective that, gee, you should have controlled that, you should have bottled that up. We'll leave maybe not completely sold on every argument, but recognizing that there are solid reasons for doing this, and it gets to some point where you realize there's a credible reason for coming out with the way they did. Right. So think about it and be able to explain it to a level that can make a convincing case.
Go ahead, Dr. Falco, sorry.
Yeah, we were very comfortable in coming to our conclusion. Indeed, we came out even stronger for the concept of free access of this information because we really believe that there has been undue attention paid to the agents of bioterrorism and the larger issue of global infectious diseases and the threat that it raises has been somewhat lost. I mean, the United States and the rest of the world is in jeopardy of coming into a microbial perfect storm if we get a new pandemic of influenza combined with increasing resistance in the pneumococcus and staphylococcus. We have to be doing research on those kinds of agents. And we have to have the free interchange of information. I mean, the best example of openness that one could imagine, and one that I cited when I wrote the preface to our report, was the SARS epidemic, in which you had a new agent that appeared on the scene. It had potentially great morbidity and mortality. And yet the international scientific community rose to it, they isolated it, they sequenced it, they made the sequence available, and within weeks there were new diagnostics, and indeed, in a fairly short period of time, there was a vaccine. And if you contrast that with the idea that let's worry about the SARS sequence and not make it available because some misguided individual might misuse it, really means that you now more or less make your biomedical enterprise dependent on a few individuals who have questionable ability in some cases.
We're talking about scientific openness and whether or not it poses a threat to security. You're welcome to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255. And let's take a call. I'd like to hear from Chris in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Sorry for the delay.
That's okay.
I was going to ask him if there's a bit of national arrogance going on about we should always be the first one to come up with these scientific breakthroughs and then they can steal it from us. I mean, isn't it an international progression as science develops and stuff? It reminds me when, you know, the spies were blamed for giving the A-bomb to Russia and that whole thing. And I'm wondering if they've got enough to teach us, too, all over the world. It's sort of an international thing rising rather than just from us to be stolen.
Well, that was one of the points that we made emphatically in our report, is that this is an international enterprise, and it is not...
Whoa. Chris, I think you better move your phone away from the receiver or something.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead, Dr. Falco.
No, I agree. It is an international enterprise, and we suggest indeed that there be an international meeting to discuss some of these issues and whether or not we can have some uniformity and how we deal with access. But it's pretty well, since the time of the Reagan administration, there has been openness in terms of the availability of genome information.
Chris, thanks very much for your call. Dr. Epstein, I wonder if this question about, you know, the international aspect isn't that's one of the things you're referring to about the complicated nature of this, because it's very hard for the United States to say this is what must be done with, and other countries say, well, that's fine for you, but we're not going to follow that.
That's right. I think there's no single country that has such power over the whole scientific enterprise that it can unilaterally take a policy that the rest of the world would, if not followed by the rest of the world, will be at all effective. The point here, in maybe not in this case, but in other cases where similar questions have come up, is not that one gives up because the international community doesn't agree, but as Dr. Falco mentioned, through a meeting or a series of discussions or a process, have this discussion all around the world. Science is the same everywhere, and if U.S. scientists happen to see a particular concern or a particular risk, it ought to be one we can make the case for other scientists as well. And if the community as a whole decides that we have to operate a little bit differently, given we have a new threat we had not taken as seriously in the past, then that discussion can continue to be held. So those discussions usually have to start somewhere. And the United States is going ahead creating an advisory board within the Department of Health and Human Services that's going to have some role within this country on similar types of questions. And one of the missions of this advisory board is to have this discussion with scientific colleagues overseas. But anything that's going to work has to be implemented internationally.
Need to pause for one quick second to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Dr. Falco, I wanted to ask you a question. I mean, isn't the cat out of the bag a little bit on this one, in the sense that, as I said earlier, you know, many of the dangerous pathogens that you might think about are already out there. I go back to my desk right now and dial up the genome sequence of smallpox if I wanted to.
You bet. My desktop, I have lots of pathogens in the, and as I think I mentioned before, really all of the microbial, both viral and bacterial agents that are considered bio threats by security people, are the sequences are out there and they are available. What is the thing that I have found interesting, and one of the aspects that has been missed in this, is that the focus on the pathogenic organisms really leaves out half the equation, and these things don't operate in a vacuum, but it's a host-pathogen interaction. And we are the hosts, and many animals are the hosts. And if you started to have the concept that we embargo genomic information, one could begin to hear people saying, well, we want to embargo the human genome as well, or the genome of rice, or the genome of domestic animals, because these are hosts. And we are going to increasingly be able to understand the genes that we possess for susceptibility or resistance to infection. And one has to take that into consideration. So one of the committee recommendations was that, quite aside from the committee that Dr. Epstein talked about that'll be in NIH, that there also be either a subcommittee of that or a separate committee that monitors the impact of genomics, if you will, in what happens technologically and ethically for the people not only of the United States but really of the world.
So, Dr. Epstein, there is a committee in place that's testing these things, and could it be different in the future? I mean, we smallpox is out there, but perhaps there's others that we should be thinking more carefully about.
There's a committee that's in the process of being formed. It's pursuant to the recommendations of a previous National Academy of Sciences report called the Fink Committee, which asked the broader question, how should the scientific community govern its own operations, or what kind of review or governance procedure should be put on the conduct of research? Dissemination reporting was one thing they looked at. But what the committee paid more attention to was enhancing a process where scientists and local institutional review boards would look at proposed activities in certain areas that were thought to pose particular questions from a security point of view, and again, consider whether this particular experiment ought to be done. The assumption in almost every case is that if there were legitimate scientific reasons to do that work, they would still be applied, they would be valid, and the work would proceed. But there may be some cases where one wouldn't want to rely on one individual investigator's decision that, gee, this is a fun thing or this is an important thing. I think it's important. There may be some areas where a bunch of other people thinking about that same topic might go, well, you might want to, that there's a reason why you might want to do that, but we think the risks overall are such that we shouldn't do that here or shouldn't do that under these circumstances. This is a very hard thing to do because you can't get a scientific proposal and kind of rack it up and say, well, it's a 29 on the good scale, but it's a 93 on the bad scale, so we're not going to do that. All of these case-by-case decisions will be pretty difficult to work out, but there does need to be a system in place so that it's not any individual's responsibility. As to the cat out of the bag question, I think an important part of this committee on the genome databases was that, as Dr. Pacco said, these genomes, many of the ones of the pathogens of interest, are already out. The broader question is, certainly as we proceed in the future continuing to do biomedical research, we may come up with some sort of information that does pose questions that isn't yet out of the bag. So the reason we need to worry about these issues is maybe we can do something before it's too late in the future.
Okay, we're talking about scientific openness and national security, and we'll be right back after this short break. Please stay with us. We're talking this hour about balancing scientific openness and national security. My guests are Gerald Epstein, adjunct professor in the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University and senior fellow for science and security in the Homeland Security Program of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and Stanley Falco, the Cahill Professor in Cancer Research and Professor of Microbiology and Immunology and of Medicine at Stanford University in Stanford, California. And let's take your calls. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's hear from Sue in Portland, Oregon. Sue, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's your question?
This conversation reminds me of a debate that happened about 700 years ago, which was, should the Bible be translated into English? Because it would give people too much knowledge.
Interesting. So your argument would be then that knowledge is knowledge is knowledge, and it's going to be available to people.
Correct. Right. You can't hide this. It's going to come out sooner or later. And people ought to know it, and the common people ought to be able to make their own judgments.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you for that, Sue. Dana, let's go to Dana in San Jose, California. Dana, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'd like to bring up the issue. Now, there's a lot of concern about giving this knowledge available, but, I mean, back 30 years ago when smallpox was actually eradicated, they actually kept two live strains of it. The Russians and the United States kept two live strains, you know, for research and whatnot. And, you know, no one has... This knowledge, while it gives you a sequence, you can't just simply, you know, put this in a machine and have you create the whole DNA, the actual DNA template of this, and, you know, throw it in a shake flask and hopefully you'll grow the organism. So really this information is almost useless without the organism, because you can't, you know, you can't deploy it, and, you know, there's no technology that exists to actually, you know, propagate this organism. So I was wondering, you know, what the committee, if the committee actually put more of an emphasis on restricting the access of, you know, live cultures to work with in these cases, rather than simply the information.
Well, I think Dr. Falco's committee wasn't even asked to do that, but Dr. Falco, you must have had some discussion about that.
Oh, sure. I mean, and there certainly are laws that are in place that restrict access to these pathogenic organisms and their shipment. I mean, that was a big part of the security issues of the Patriots Act, for example, and that is certainly true. On the other hand, it's designed with the idea that people might want to break in and steal these cultures, and it sometimes overlooks the reality that if you are a sophisticated malefactor, you just go into nature and you can get those organisms any place. I mean, not that far from the president's Texas ranch, you can find the plague alive and well, and virtually everything but smallpox is out there in the real universe. So it is important, I think, to be vigilant, and it's important not to let the actual live organisms fall into the wrong hands. On the other hand, if there is somebody who is determined to do so, they can.
I see. Dana, thanks for the call. But Dr. Falco, I'm wondering, though, are there not some rudimentary attempts to... Maybe not with something as complex as smallpox or plague bacteria, but aren't there some rudimentary attempts to sort of go the other direction and use the sequence to at least, well, certainly they've been making proteins for a long time, but to make an organism?
Well, I mean, there was a great deal of concern when one investigator synthesized the polio virus synthetically. And what happened is that the actual product that was made in the laboratory wasn't as good as the product that nature makes. So there was a certain lesson in that. But the idea of manipulating a pathogen to make it do what you want it to do sounds very good on paper, but I've been doing this for over 40 years, and let me tell you, it's very hard. Okay. To just understand how the natural pathogen works, let alone trying to do better than God did.
Dr. Epstein.
I would like to add, however, the point that something that was just very hard now will be less hard tomorrow and less hard than that a year from now. And as time goes on, our knowledge increases, our capabilities increase, and something that might seem too hard to do or not worth worrying about today might be something that is actually a concern.
And I agree that is potentially possible in the future, and there would be ongoing discussions about this, but the best defense, it seems to me, against this kind of thing happening is to have open access and free interchange and people working on infectious diseases of all kinds, because that's how you learn how to cure and prevent a lot of infections, and it is I think it's a difficult task to manipulate an organism, but it is going to be possible not only to manipulate organisms, but unfortunately to manipulate hosts and make them more susceptible. But in principle, we also understand that we can make hosts, that is us, more resistant to infectious diseases, and I think that's going to be one of the great things that's going to happen in the future as well.
So, I
don't think that you can put your national biomedical efforts in infectious diseases dictated by what a relatively small handful of people might do in the future.
Let's take a call from Sam in Boca Raton, Florida. Sam, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How are you all?
Fine. How are you?
I am fine. Great. Thank you. I'm a senior at Florida Atlantic University. My degree will be in biotechnology, and I want to be pursuing my doctoral degree in genetics, specifically doing some stem cell research. And the problem that I have with the whole security issue is that we rely on, you know, many different sources, bioinformatics databases, et cetera. And I don't want to feel like being put under the microscope to do my research, or at least limit my capabilities of seeking out information that may or may not pertain to my research. So I think the whole security issue, I think that the federal government should, they're planning to overhaul it anyway. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. It's inevitable. My point is that I would like to see a separate, like, committee or whatever word you want to apply to this this branch that will take care of such security issues in the scientific field. Like, for example, seeking out those individuals who are trying to obtain information to synthesize anthrax, botulism, and potentially very dangerous pathogens or mutants there, for lack of a better word.
Sam, thanks for the call. Dr. Epstein, it seems to me in some of the work you've written about this is where your concept of transparency comes in, so that people can actually be aware of, anybody who wants to look can actually be aware. Is that a way of dealing with this problem? To force openness as much as possible?
Well, that's one way, and of course that introduces a whole set of issues we haven't even brought up here yet. But I try to draw a toolkit of things one might do if one were concerned about the problem that research might lead to the development of pathogens which would be used as weapons. One set of tools is constraints on publication of some sort, and I think whenever you look in detail at that route, it doesn't end up being very effective or easy to implement or even easy to define. So there may be situations where that's appropriate, but it's hard to find. One is more reviews about what's done initially, and I think people should have a better idea when they start something that might go down one of these roads. If there's a way to foretell that, they might want to think before they've done the work rather than afterwards. One way may be, let's not worry about controlling this for all the reasons we've mentioned. You can't control information, someone will get it, it's too damaging to try and do that. But maybe there's some sense that if people are working in areas which can have potentially very serious consequences, maybe there's some additional or greater obligation on people working in those areas to make clear what it is they're doing. So don't want to try and constrain the work, but keep a better tab of who's doing it. The problem here is then, again, if one does everything openly, there may be particular details that would be useful to somebody who's trying to be malicious. And so it may not be a solution that fits all possible problems.
I need to take a brief pause to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're talking about the question of whether particularly genome sequences should be freely and openly available, or whether that some kind of restriction for concern about national security should be put in place. And we're anxious to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call from John in Cary, Illinois. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make the point that, and I think this was already brought up somewhat, but that these pathogens are readily available. I mean, anthrax can be cultured from dirt. It's everywhere. And it's not particularly difficult to do that. However, developing cures and actual things that will protect us from these things takes extensive research. And another issue that I have is that hasn't been addressed on any of these shows that talks about security is that we aren't addressing the legitimate concerns of people in the third world. And, the English and the Irish fought for over 800 years, and they kept it up until they sat down at a table with legitimate conversations on those topics. So I think this is an interesting conversation, but I don't think that it gets to the real issue.
Right. Well, John, thanks for that call. The question here isn't so much about the organisms themselves, but the genomic sequences. And I guess that puts us into the realm of, one of our earlier callers, about just basic information, not knowing exactly what you can do with it. I mean, I suppose if you had a vial of anthrax, you could throw it at someone and there was a chance it could hurt them. But having the genome sequence, it doesn't really give you anything to throw. Dr. Epstein.
the question of how can information hurt people, I think it's very difficult to answer that because you have to have some assumption of what is it people want to do, what information are they going to do it with. But I think part of the conversation is complicated because we're not being clear on who is it that we think is going to use this information. Some people may be coming at the problem thinking, I don't want to give somebody a basic roadmap on how to culture bacteria because they may be able to brew something up. If that's a concern, we'll have to lock up every high school biology book. If it's the roadmap, the actual techniques, that's one thing and leads to one solution, which is probably not doable. Another concern is that the state of the art, some advanced piece of research done for the first time, enables somebody to engineer an organism with a property that we might not have thought we could do before. And I'm sure Dr. Falco will point out that that's not something we necessarily can do based on any one piece of research. But I do want to hold out the question that there may be research which is done which does lead to the development of a terrible biological pathogen. And again, the reason this is such an important issue in the biological sciences, as opposed to every other field of technology where we worry about what people might do to harm, is that biology can actually have planetary consequences. We can imagine some very scary scenarios, and you can get to those very scary scenarios easier in biology than in many other fields. It could be an organism itself rather than the huge industrial infrastructure.
Well, you know, this conversation reminds me of ones that we had about 30 years ago when I served on the recombinant DNA committee, when genetic cloning was discovered, and people were asking me questions like, what happens if you put, you know, the genes of a fruit fly into E. coli? And all I could tell them was, I know the little sucker won't fly, but not much else. And there were a lot of people who were concerned about manipulation of genomes and of all kinds and what would happen. And that's been an ongoing, continuing dialogue. But one of the things that was done was the setup of local committees, which included public participation, to review some of these some research proposals. And that still exists today. And my understanding is that that's one of the things that will be done as well in terms of whether or not there are dual use, to use a term that Dr. Epstein has used before, kinds of research being done.
Dr. Falco, we have to leave it there. I'm afraid we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest this hour, Stanley Falco, the Cahill Professor in Cancer Research at Stanford University in Stanford, California, and Gerald Epstein, Adjunct Professor in the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. Thanks to both of you for joining me today. This program is produced by Annette Heist, Charles Bergquist, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Bergquist is also our web producer. We had help today from Chad Campbell, who directed this hour, Brendan Banaszak, and Charlie Foster in Washington. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. For internet mail, you can send us a note at scifry@npr.org. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.